Good evening. How are you all doing tonight? Well, this evening. Before we get started, I just want to welcome everyone to Consciousness Cultivation Change. It's our Black History kickoff event, BALSA, the Black Law Students Association. And before we get started with our featured presentation, I would like to actually recognize a couple of people who are here today. The first two people I'd like to recognize if they're in the room are Amadou Kinkeli, Diaud. I just butchered your name. And then also Amina Lloyd. They are BALSA's Black History Month coordinators, and they will be passing around a calendar via email for all of you to get involved this month in our activities. Also, I would like to personally thank Ms. Kiana Jamison, who's also overseeing the activities of this month. In addition to that, I'd like to recognize the Center for the Study of Race and Law. They are co-sponsors to this event. And lastly, I would like to recognize members of the BALSA mock trial team. If you could please stand. You guys are here. This weekend we had a regional convention in which our mock trial team participated and competed. And there are only two schools that are allowed to advance to nationals, and UVA did a sweep, and both of our teams will be advancing to nationals for the competition in Detroit. So I was told to give some opening remarks, and I didn't quite know what I was going to say. And so I struggled to the last minute to figure out, what is it that I'm going to share with you guys? There's no kernel of wisdom here. And so, of course, whenever you're in a panic, your mother kind of comes in the back of your head. And so my mother came in the back of my head, and she said, "Don't try, Dana, just do." And she always used to say this. As a little girl, if I was late for something, I'd be like, "I'm sorry I'm late." She's like, "I didn't ask for you to be late. I asked you to be on time. Don't try, just do." And so we, as law students, are actually in a detrimentally comfortable position right now in our lives to not do, but simply to try. As 3Ls, you're kind of relaxing, you're kind of coasting, you're pretty much done with this law school thing. As 2Ls, we have the callbacks, and we're kind of running all the student organizations here on campus. And as 1Ls, you are quite simply put in academic hell. We all have the work, we all have the load, and despite this burden, there is some felicity, some complacency, and that some of us, or many of us, find in this ability to just try and not to do. With all of the world's events occurring around us, many of us can easily use the excuse of the books or the pages to conveniently take ourselves out of the action. "Well, at least I tried," many of us will say. And in that respect, we feel entitled to excuse ourselves from these daily events simply because we're here. We're here at UVA Law. This year, however, BALSA made a conscious decision to not engage in such a mentality. When choosing its theme for the year, Consciousness, Cultivation, Change, trying was not in our vocabulary. Rather, we were committed to taking affirmative steps towards bringing a conscious light to relevant issues, cultivating the minds of our community, particularly our 1Ls, and enacting change by using our legal tools and using our growing legal minds. This year, I'm a pretty proud president of BALSA. This year, we engaged in a number of community service events, such as partnering with the Ronald McDonald House, working alongside the Shelter for Help in Emergency, hosting the first annual diversity reception for minority students, dedicating resources to student scholarships, decreasing rates of malaria infections in Africa, raised $1,700 for the Blue Ridge Food Bank, and we're about to go on the Hill next Wednesday to lobby for Gulf Coast relief. Furthermore, BALSA this year facilitated in the discourse with regards to racial disparities in sentencing and bringing light to the GINA 6 issues. And today, BALSA has the privilege of honoring Professor Michael J. Klarman, who will speak on his newly released book, Unfinished Business, a title that so aptly suggests that, once again, that complacency and entitlement remain incongruent to the events of today, and the solace we may take in being in the law school bubble. But before we have Professor Carmen introduced by Professor Ford Mazzouri, I would like to bring up our community service chair, Samaya Ellard.
Good evening. My name is Samaya Ellard, and I'm the Community Service Coordinator this year for BALSA. Especially pleased this evening to announce our winner of BALSA's inaugural scholarship competition. We decided this year, in our efforts to foster community relationships, that it was important that BALSA encourage thought and discussion among students about the social ills that affect our community. And so in light of the passing of Oliver Hill and his great legacy, we decided to focus on the inequities of our educational system. The scholarship was offered to UVA undergraduates, and it was in the amount of $1,000. So students were challenged to demonstrate an outstanding grasp of the significance of Oliver Hill Sr.'s legacy, as well as what they perceived was their personal role in continued activism. We received some great submissions. They were all outstanding, but the winning essayist demonstrated a comprehensive response to the question, which surprisingly all of the essayists chose to answer, which was, what do you think is the greatest social problem challenging our nation's educational systems today, and why? Kadeem Cooper, who is a sophomore at the University of Virginia, decided to talk about his personal perspective in dealing with New York's public school systems, as well as the problematic, what he saw, the resegregation along racial and economic lines of our nation's schools. So Akadeem indicated that the contest gave him an opportunity to reflect on the progress of social equality in education, to look at how far we've come and how far we have to go. As a native of Brooklyn, majoring in foreign affairs, he says he has a keen interest in public policy, especially the inequities of salary and education. So BALSA is thrilled to announce that Kadeem Cooper is the winner of our inaugural scholarship competition, and what we hope will become a long-standing tradition in BALSA's history. So we would just like to congratulate him.
Thank you, Samaya. And now I would just like to introduce Professor Kim Ford Mazzouri. Professor Kim Ford Mazzouri is the Justice Thurgood Marshall Distinguished Professor in Law and also serves as the Director for the Center for the Study of Race in Law. He teaches courses in criminal law and procedure, constitutional law, and race in law. Go figure. His research interests include race and criminal procedure, race in the child placement process, affirmative action, and reparations. And also, Professor Kim Ford Mazzouri has published articles including Learning Law Through the Lenses of Race, Taking Conservatives Seriously, A Moral Justification for Affirmative Action and Reparations, Black Identity in Child Placement, The Best Interests of Black and Biracial Children. Without further ado, I would like to bring forward Professor Kim Ford Mazzouri.
Thank you, Dana, and thank you to BALSA for arranging this terrific event, and I'm privileged to introduce Michael Klarman. I could do a fairly conventional introduction in which I would share with you his distinguished position as the James Monroe Distinguished Professor of Law and the Elizabeth and Richard Merrill Research Professor. I could mention his stellar education from his BA and MA at Pennsylvania, his JD from Stanford, where he served on the Law Review, and his PhD as a Marshall Scholar from Oxford. I could also mention the awards he's received, the first trainer award that the faculty has given for outstanding legal scholarship, the several teaching awards he's won both university-wide and statewide. I might even mention that his book, Jim Crow to Civil Rights, won the prestigious Columbia University's Bancroft Prize in 2005, which is a real honor, and I believe wasn't granted to a legal historian for at least 20 years before that. but you all know that about him, and you can see that on his bio. So I won't bother with that. What I'll do instead is say what you are less aware of and what I see from my perspective, and that is to say why Mike Klarman is such a role model to me, both as a professor and as a person. And I want to use this opportunity to let him know as he goes off to Harvard how much he will be missed. And many of you who know him or who've had him as a teacher will recognize these traits. And I'm just naming a few, but some of the traits that I admire so much in Mike, I even feel privileged to call him Mike. It makes me want to call him Professor because he's such a towering figure, literally and metaphorically. Mike is a person, just to name a few traits, of tremendous generosity, humility, and commitment to truth. And you see this often, you know, those who've had him as teachers or as students know this, that he opens his class to hundreds of students and spends so much time preparing for class. I remember going by his office once a few years ago, and it was before con law, and he was trying to work out something about a case he's teaching, and I haven't you taught this for like 15 years, and he was just felt he didn't quite have it right, he could do it better. I mean, he is dedicated to doing it right. And opening up your class to that many students, you may not realize how much time that requires of grading. Here's a devoted husband to Lisa. In fact, that's who he dedicates his recent book to his lovely wife. He's also a father of four and of many cats. yet he spends weeks at a time during the holiday season grading the hundreds of exams that he gets from his students. He's also a person of humility. And that generosity extends as a colleague, reading people's drafts, giving people's comments. When people come from, I remember this justice from the Supreme Court of Canada came down, and he's quick to say, you know, if you want me to host a panel for him and I'll debate with him. He's always there to try and contribute in ways, often in ways that are less obvious to people. But he's also a person of humility. He's someone who could be, and deservedly so, as proud and confident and frankly as arrogant as anyone we know, many people not at this school, but perhaps some schools further north and east, have egos. have egos that could not fit in this room. and Mike Klarman is not one of them. Like I said, he deserves to be because he's outstanding, but he's a person who just believes in the equality and dignity of all people, and he feels he's no better than anybody else. And you see that in just the way he deals with people and how he considers people. And he's also committed to truth, and that's perhaps obvious from his scholarly achievements, but one of the remarkable aspects of his scholarship, race and constitutional history are areas that are just deeply involving normative, moral, compelling justice issues. And it's hard to read and study and know what goes on in these areas without being moved to it, without getting angry, without being hurt, without wanting to, in a sense, put justice beyond what the complexity of the facts might reveal. And Mike is extremely moral. It's not to say that, but in his scholarship, he's led by the facts, no matter how complicated they are. This book itself is a terrific read, but it's a challenging read because Mike doesn't write to entertain. He writes to inform, and he will write about the most gruesome injustices that have happened, but in a way that pays attention to the facts, the complexities, careful not necessarily to blame where blame isn't necessarily due, given the historical context, given the challenges that people face. And in the end, you're moved, but you're moved by the truth that he reveals rather than because he has told you from the outset that you should be moved or how you should be moved. Then just turning to myself, I've just benefited personally tremendously from the minute I got here in 1996. I'm teaching criminal law, you sort of approach professors and say, can you share your notes? And you've got to be a little bit tentative about that because professors are somewhat protective of their notes. You know, they've worked on those jokes a while. They don't want them to get out to other classes and the like. And sometimes I could tell that people were uncomfortable sharing, and I wouldn't push it. Mike immediately shared all his criminal law notes, and they're just these transcripts of lectures. I mean, they're just gold. I tried rehearsing. I couldn't quite get it down, so I just used them more as notes to consult. That and many other ways, reading my drafts. Let me back up 1 minute. I mentioned sort of the generosity and humility. I am legally blind and can't drive, and Mike's, again, one of the unseen things, literally unseen for me, is, you know, if there's a dinner somewhere out, he's always the first to email me, do you need a ride home? So those are some of the ways in which he just reaches out again with that humility. But I did want to end on his support for scholarship, because that returns to the issue of his scholarship as well. If you read my articles, you'll see in the first footnote his name mentioned in virtually all of them. They really should be in bold because he really has given me the greatest amount of feedback, constructive and helpful, of anybody. And it combines his truth and his honesty. He's brutally honest sometimes where it hurts, but that's what enables you to improve your scholarship, because he challenges you, and he says when he's not persuaded by a particular point. But that again takes a lot of time, generosity, honesty, and respect. I remember a 110-page draft that he gave sort of 10 pages of single-space comments, very careful, and again, in some cases, critical. But I, you know, after crying over it, I took it and realized the sense in a lot of the points he made, and I worked hard on revisiting. And then I recall he was visiting at Stanford, and we were all, you know, praying that he would reject their bad weather and the like. Anyway, I happened to present a later draft of that paper, taking conservatives seriously, as Dana mentioned, and Mike was in the audience at Stanford. And I was like, uh-oh, I hope he's not going to reveal what he really thinks of it. But I had really worked hard, not accepting all his comments, but taking them seriously as he did, as he took my paper seriously. I recall he came up to me afterwards and said, you know, you really turned this into a successful piece. That was priceless. I'm here today, and I managed to get tenure, in large part because of the mentorship that Michael Klarman has given me. I think the fact that Harvard is hiring him, to me, is the best evidence that they're a great school. Mike, we're going to miss you. Keep in touch. Check the weather. I think we're doing better than Boston today. You're a great colleague. You're a great mentor. You're a great role model. And you're a great friend. Give it up for Michael Klarman.
I think I just figured out who's giving the eulogy at my funeral. That's an incredibly warm and generous and quite unjustified introduction. I'm thankful to Kim for that. I'm honored that BALSA has asked me to kick off the Black History Month celebration. I confess I was almost too depressed to show up given the results in the Super Bowl. It's not really that I'm a Patriots fan. I don't really care that much about the Patriots, but I believe deeply in the principle that New York sports teams should win nothing. I'm kidding about that. Most of you know that my passion is baseball, not football. I'm hoping one day that I can combine my principal passions, baseball and constitutional history. Some of you heard me talk about a book I'd like to write one day, which would be about the history of desegregation in sports, specifically in baseball, and comparing it with desegregation in other spheres of life like education. I think that would be a really interesting book, unfortunately more interesting than the book that I'm going to talk to you about today. I do say, though, with some pride that this book, Unfinished Business, was released by Oxford University Press in October 2007, which is the same month that the Red Sox won the World Series and consummated their dynasty. More importantly, the same month that for another year the Yankees did not win the World Series. I'm going to talk to you about the history of race relations in the United States. In the book, I've had to distill that into 50,000 words, which is not easy. Balsa has asked me to distill it into 20 minutes. I may go just a little bit beyond that, but I doubt if I'll talk for 25. I want to make several discrete observations. I have 8 points that I want to talk about, and I'll offer an illustration or two about each of those 8 points. If I had time for a 9th point, I think we'd talk a little bit about how the Giants really shouldn't have been allowed to participate in the Super Bowl this year, but we're probably not going to have time for that, so we'll stick with 8. First point, racial progress in American history has not been ineluctable. I think there's a conventional wisdom that the United States has continually and almost inevitably moved in the direction of greater racial equality. During the colonial period, we had slavery throughout the nation in the North as well as the South. As a result of the Revolutionary War, slavery was put on the road to extinction in the North. As a result of the Civil War, of course, slavery was finally ended in the South. Slavery was replaced by a system of white supremacy known as Jim Crow. That system was gradually undermined through the course of the 20th century until it was finally eliminated through some combination of the Supreme Court's decision in Brown in 1954 and the Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. I want to suggest to you that's a fairly misleading narrative. Certainly we've made progress, but the progress has come in fits and starts, and there have actually been periods when clearly what we've experienced has been racial retrogression. I'll just note one example, though there are many that one could give. Maybe the most obvious example is Reconstruction and its aftermath. In 1870, African Americans could vote in the South and turned out to vote in huge numbers. There were hundreds, if not thousands, of African American office holders in the South. Blacks sat on juries. Many states had laws forbidding discrimination in public accommodations. 30 years later, African Americans were almost universally disfranchised in the South. Blacks no longer served in office. Blacks no longer served on juries. The number of lynchings had reached an annual figure of something like 100. Some years in the 1890s, 200. It's clear that African Americans in the South were better off in 1870 than they were 30 years later in 1900. Sorry, my math skills aren't that good. Second point, racial progress has not been primarily a result of whites doing the right thing. Again, I think there's a kind of misleading narrative, which is perhaps most famously affiliated with Gunnar Myrdal and his book, An American Dilemma, published during World War II. And the basic idea behind Myrdal's book is there is this American ethic of racial equality, which is articulated in the Declaration of Independence, and it's simply taken some time for racial practices to move closer and closer to evolve in the direction of that ideal of racial equality. I think that's not true. I think that most of the progress that's been accomplished has been a result of African Americans fighting every inch of the way, and that in itself was not sufficient. In addition, conditions have had to be ripe for racial progress to be made. So those are my second and third points. African Americans fighting for progress, conditions having to be such that they facilitated racial progress. On the point about African Americans fighting for their rights, I'll offer two illustrations. President Franklin Roosevelt issued a famous executive order during World War II, which forbade race discrimination in government contracting, military contracting. He did that not primarily because it was the right thing to do. If it was the right thing to do, it could have easily been done decades earlier. He did it because of a threatened march on Washington led by the eminent labor leader A. Philip Randolph. with the country on the precipice of World War II. The president was terribly concerned at the prospect of 100,000 angry African Americans marching on Washington, so he gave in to the pressure and issued this executive order. Second illustration, in the 1960s, the Kennedy administration finally came in support of the Civil Rights Bill that ultimately became the 1964 Civil Rights Act, not primarily because it was the right thing to do, but because of the pressure of the Birmingham street demonstrations. Americans were repulsed by these images of police dogs and fire hoses being used against peaceful children protesting in the streets, and that forced the administration's hand. Third point, blacks demanding their rights has not been a sufficient condition. There has to be as well external supportive conditions, economic, political, social conditions that are facilitative of racial change. There are a lot of deep-seated forces that have contributed to the possibility of racial progress, things like the growing education in the African-American community, urbanization. I'll focus on one primarily, which historians call the Great Migration, beginning during World War I. Over a period of about 50 years, 5 million African Americans relocated from the rural South to the urban North. That by itself meant increased political power because blacks were almost universally disfranchised in the rural South. In the North, not only did they vote largely without racial restriction, but they also often held the balance of power between two roughly evenly divided political parties. So the simple transformation of African Americans from a predominantly southern population into a group that was divided evenly between the South and the North increased black political power. African Americans were drawn to the North primarily by the opening of industrial opportunities. Economic power translates ultimately into political and social power. Think about the Montgomery bus boycott as an example. That's African Americans trying to use their economic clout to secure a measure of racial equality. In the North, African Americans found better schools, and it's hard to imagine a social protest movement being very successful without an educated leadership and indeed an educated group of foot soldiers. In addition, in the North, it was possible for African Americans to demonstrate a kind of militancy that would have been violently suppressed in the South. Newspapers like the Chicago Defender, which could not possibly have been published in the South in the 19-teens or 1920s, were entirely possible in the North. So the move of African Americans to the North played a vitally important role in the modern civil rights movement. I really want to emphasize, because I think this point is not widely understood, but I think it's very important. It's almost impossible to reform a quasi-totalitarian system like white supremacy entirely from within. African Americans in the South had no political power because they were disenfranchised. They had very little economic power because most of them were tenant farmers and sharecroppers. They lived in an environment that was ripe with violence. Street protests in the 1910s or 1920s were entirely out of the question, and an era when African Americans were still being lynched at astonishing rates. The only way to change such a system is with pressure from the outside. That external pressure was contributed by African Americans who had migrated to the North, who began to influence the opinions of Northern whites and ultimately the national government, and they used that pressure to try to leverage change in the Jim Crow South. That's how to think about anti-lynching legislation, which was the primary item on the NAACP's agenda in the 1920s. Anti-lynching legislation is an effort by Northern congressmen with large black constituencies to pass legislation that will help Southern blacks. That's also the way to understand the NAACP. In its early decades, it's primarily a Northern organization which is trying to improve the situation for Southern blacks. Great Migration is a long-term factor. There are also short-term factors that have been instrumental in racial progress. It turns out, perhaps somewhat ironically, wars have been incredibly important in the history of racial progress in the United States. The Revolutionary War, as I think many people don't know, was critical to putting slavery on the road to extinction in the North. It also temporarily weakened the institution in the South, although it quickly became entrenched. The Civil War, of course, not only abolished slavery in the United States, but resulted in post-war amendments securing a certain measure of civil and political equality to African Americans. And World War II turned out to be the vanguard of the modern civil rights movement, I think for at least four reasons. One is the ideology of the war. The United States was fighting Nazi fascists with their theories of white supremacy, but doing so with a racially segregated army, which struck many people as hard to reconcile. Second factor, as many as a million African Americans served in the military during the war. That means they risked their lives. Many lost their lives fighting for democracy. Yet those who returned, when they returned home to Alabama or Mississippi, were denied the right to vote in the only elections that mattered, Democratic Party primaries. It's no accident the United States Supreme Court struck down the white primary as unconstitutional during the war. Third factor, an acceleration of the Great Migration. Another 1.5 million African Americans moved from the rural South to the urban North during the 1940s. This was having a profound effect on national politics by 1948, when both the Democratic and the Republican parties ran candidates who were strongly committed to civil rights. The fourth factor comes out of the war, after the war. It's known by historians as the Cold War imperative. The United States and the Soviet Union are struggling against each other for the allegiance of the Third World. Most of the Third World is non-white. The Soviets were using American racial segregation and discrimination as their number one propaganda weapon to convince people in Asia, Africa, and Latin America that American capitalist democracy was tantamount to white supremacy. The United States needed to solve this problem in order to have a chance in competing for the hearts and minds of the Third World against the Soviets. The result of these various factors coming out of World War II was dramatic change in racial attitudes and practices. Jackie Robinson, with an assist from Branch Rickey, desegregated Major League Baseball in 1946-1947. Harry Truman desegregated the military and the Federal Civil Service in 1948. Even in the South, profound racial changes were afoot. African Americans were serving for the first time since Reconstruction on juries. Black voter registration in the South increased fourfold in the decade of the 1940s, and blacks were starting to participate on minor league baseball teams, even in citadels of segregation like Birmingham and Montgomery, Alabama. I hope somebody is counting the number of baseball references in this ostensibly non-baseball focused talk. Fourth point, racial progress often has unintended consequences. Let me restate that. Racial progress is often an unintended consequence of actions that were taken for other objectives. I'll just give you one illustration here, but I think American history is ripe with examples of this. The Civil War, which is a pretty prominent example. The North initially fought the Civil War not to end slavery, but to preserve the Union. The North Republican Party, the party committed to constraining the spread of slavery, as many of you know, was prepared to support a constitutional amendment in 1861 that would have forever prohibited Congress from interfering with slavery in existing states. That, ironically, could have been the 13th Amendment. Congress stated the war aims of the nation several months into the war and explicitly disavowed the notion that the war was about slavery. The purpose of the war was to preserve the Union, not to end slavery. It's almost certainly the case if the South had laid down its arms in the first year of the war, slavery could and would have been preserved. Now, obviously, this changed over the course of the war, largely as a function of the war not going well. Lincoln decided by the summer of 1862 that it was necessary to emancipate slaves, primarily as an effort to undermine the South's labor force. And indeed, if you enrolled African Americans in the Union military, you were in a sense doubling the advantage. You were subtracting them from the South's labor force and adding them to the Union's military forces. Okay, ultimately the war became a war against slavery, though it's worth noting, and I'm not sure everybody understands this, the Emancipation Proclamation was incredibly controversial. It clearly cost the Republican Party many seats in Congress in the fall of 1862, and it led to draft riots, most prominently in New York City in the summer of 1863, when working class Irish Catholics revolted against the idea of being conscripted into an army that was fighting to emancipate slaves. The Civil War ultimately ended slavery, but that's not why the war was initially undertaken. Fifth point, relatedly, whites have often had ulterior motives for adopting the policies that ended up producing racially progressive outcomes. I'll give you two illustrations here. The Republican Party, which supported and ultimately enacted the 15th Amendment in 1870, did so largely not because it was the right thing to do, but because they understood African Americans would vote overwhelmingly for the Republican Party, which they did, and was the only way the Republican Party had a chance of getting established in the South. Second illustration, I've already alluded to the Cold War imperative. Those racially progressive actions that were taken by the Truman administration in the 1940s and the Eisenhower administration in the 1950s were largely taken for the reason of the Cold War imperative. When the Truman Justice Department told the justices in Brown that they should strike down racial segregation in public schools, the argument that was first and foremost was a quotation from the State Department: racial discrimination is grist for the Soviet propaganda mills. You need to strike down segregation as a matter of national security. Point number six, there is a very important but I think not widely understood dynamic by which much of the racial progress that the United States has made has taken place. Now, I only have time to talk about one illustration of this, and I'm going to refer to the mid-19th century, but I think you can make almost the same point about the mid-20th century, and some of you know enough about the history to, I think, fill in the details. The dynamic is this. The North and the South start out having somewhat different racial regimes. They don't have to be dramatically different. The North put slavery on the road to extinction as a result of the Civil War, although, as many of you know, the North is no racial paradise in the antebellum era. The South continues to have slavery, and indeed it becomes entrenched. Southerners become concerned, somewhat defensive, somewhat paranoid, that the North may use its power to intervene in Southern race relations, and they start to ask for guarantees. So to take an example, Southerners are concerned that Northern abolitionists are luring slaves into escaping, so they ask for a more efficient fugitive slave law, which they get from Congress in 1850. That fugitive slave law, however, has the effect of alienating Northerners even further from sympathy for the South. The Fugitive Slave Act potentially requires Northern citizens to be conscripted into posses that will drag terrified slaves back into slavery, sometimes with the assistance of federal troops. There are many incidents, especially in places like Boston in the 1850s, that have a profound effect alienating Northern opinion from slavery. Northern politicians try to scare Northern voters, many of whom don't really care very much about what happens to slaves in the South, but are terribly concerned that the Southern slave power might be able to interfere with their liberties in the North, for example, by making them complicit in the recapture and return of fugitive slaves. So Northerners become more alienated from support for slavery. They resist compromising. This makes Southerners even more anxious and defensive and in need of assurance, so they ask for greater protections from the national government. By 1860, Southern Democrats are asking for a federal slave code for the territories. That demand strikes more Northerners as outrageous. They get driven even further into opposition to slavery. They vote Republican. When a Republican president is elected, who's not even on the ballot in the South, that leads Southerners to secede. I think that same basic dynamic is at work in the mid-20th century. It's very powerful, and once it begins, it's very hard to stop it. Point number seven, all the changes I noted a few minutes ago taking place in the South in the late 40s and early 50s, all of them happened, I want to emphasize, before Brown versus Board of Education was decided in 1954. So the next point I want to make has to do with the role of the Supreme Court in American racial progress. As a law professor, it's obligatory to say something about the court. It turns out this book says a lot about the court. I'll just point out, many of you may not know, that several of the justices who decided Brown versus Board of Education were diehard baseball fans. They often canceled opening day, canceled court so they could go to opening day at, was it Griffith Field? Is that what they called the stadium in Washington? Yeah, it doesn't even qualify as Major League Baseball. It's the Washington Senators, but it was the best thing they had. Okay, I want to make two points about the Supreme Court and race, and these are my last two points, points seven and eight. First point, court not reliably on the right side, not reliably on the progressive side of race issues, Brown notwithstanding. Second point, whether or not the court was on the right side, I want to suggest that the court more or less has reflected racial opinion in the country in all of its decisions involving race. Okay, so the first point. Historically, the court has opposed the interests of racial minorities at least as often as the court has supported those interests. Before the Civil War, the court was a reliable friend of slavery. In Prigg versus Pennsylvania in 1842, the court both sustained the constitutionality of the Federal Fugitive Slave Act and struck down northern state laws that attempted to protect free blacks from kidnapping. In the infamous Dred Scott decision in 1857, the court both struck down an effort by Congress to restrict the spread of slavery into federal territories, and the court ruled that even free blacks did not have rights that white people were bound to respect. After the Civil War, in several prominent decisions, the Supreme Court reversed the criminal convictions of individuals who had engaged in lynching or racial massacres of African Americans, as well as striking down the federal civil rights statute, the 1875 Civil Rights Act, in the famous civil rights cases of 1883. In the early 20th century, the court on numerous occasions upheld segregation schemes and upheld Southern schemes for disfranchising black voters. Over the last four decades, since the end of the Warren Court, the Supreme Court more often than not has struck down affirmative action measures and has struck down minority voting districts, which are efforts to promote political representation by minority racial groups. Just this past year, in the summer of 2007, the Roberts Court ruled that the voluntary use of racial criteria in the allocation of public school students violated the 14th Amendment, even if the objective was to promote racial integration rather than segregation. That is, I would submit to you, an extraordinary perversion of the original understanding of the 14th Amendment led by justices who purport to be committed to the original understanding in their method of constitutional interpretation. It's really only for the half century from World War I through the 1960s that the court has fairly reliably been on the progressive side of racial issues. Okay, the last point has to do with the relationship between the court's decisions and public opinion. I want to suggest that even the court's more progressive decisions more often than not reflected public opinion rather than resisted it. Just to take an example or two, when the court in 1944 struck down the white primary, there were Gallup polls showing that something like 70% of Americans supported efforts by the federal government to undermine the disfranchisement of Southern blacks. It's not widely known that when the Brown decision was handed down in 1954, Gallup polls showed that a majority, concededly a narrow majority, but a majority of the country agreed with the Brown decision from the day it was handed down. So even when the court has supported the interests of racial minorities, more often than not, the court was reflecting dominant opinion rather than resisting it. Now, to be fair, we should also note that the court's more regressive decisions also reflected public opinion. If we're not inclined to give the court a great deal of credit for its progressive decisions, perhaps we shouldn't give it a great deal deal of blame for its regressive ones. On both occasions, it is more often than not, maybe universally, reflecting dominant public opinion. So when the court said in 1857 that blacks had no rights that whites were bound to respect, the court almost certainly was reflecting dominant opinion in the country. African Americans in 1857 could only vote in 5 states. They were excluded from office almost everywhere, excluded from juries. They were either segregated or excluded from public education throughout the North, as well as, of course, in the South. There were actually several northern states that barred blacks from even migrating into those states. So I don't think there's much doubt when the Supreme Court said in Dred Scott that African Americans have no rights that whites are bound to respect. Most of the country agreed with that. Same thing's true in 1896 when the Supreme Court decided Plessy. By 1896, even the Republican Party, the Party of Emancipation, the Party of Abraham Lincoln, had largely given up on the cause of racial equality. The Supreme Court decision in Plessy was barely noticed in national newspapers, much less criticized. The New York Times reported it in a page 3 column on railroad news. It was a case, as you may recall, involving segregation on railroads. I don't think there's much doubt that when Plessy was decided, that's what most of the white Americans believed in 1896. It's even worth noting, and this is the point I'll close on, that when the Roberts Court in 2007 invalidated student allocation policies that took into account race with the goal of promoting racial integration, when the Roberts Court struck those down, only about 5 or 10% of the school districts in the country were still using those policies. I think the court struck down these policies at a time that opinion polls show most Americans, although they support racial integration in the abstract, actually strongly oppose the idea that government ought to be in the business of promoting racial integration. Okay? On that happy note, I think I will stop and take questions. Thank you. Like
Professor Fordman's early class, he kind of provided a little bit of a paraphrasing for what you said about racial progress wasn't happening when blacks stand up. And it's, what he said is when it's in the white self-interest to allow it to happen. And I was wondering, what is the white self-interest in perpetuating racism today? I mean, why are we better off? Broken inner city communities, high rates of teen pregnancy, and, millions of young black men in jail.
Right. So let me start more generally and then work back to the specific point about today. It is a complicated question what motivates people to get behind movements for racial progress. There have always been white people who supported change in racial practices and attitudes because it was the right thing to do. The abolitionists were extraordinary people for their time. They were a small percentage of the population. They were vilified. They were burned in effigy. William Lloyd Garrison was almost lynched for his progressive views at the time. They were motivated by deep moral and often religious commitments. But they were, it's important to emphasize, a very small percentage of the population. It's only when larger groups of people can be mobilized in support that things change. So I don't deny that some noble people who are out in front are doing things because they believe it's the right thing to do. I don't think you get masses of society moving in that direction. So I'm convinced that the reason why World War II was transformative is because during war you couldn't afford racial division, and how can you convince African Americans to fight for World War II if they're being denied their rights, and how can you compete with the Soviet Union for the allegiance of the Third World when you're not treating black people decently at home? The questions today are very complicated. I hold in my mind two very different views of where we stand today. On the one hand, extraordinary progress that could not have been imagined by most people 50 years ago has been made. An African American may well be the next president of the United States. That's entirely plausible. That was unimaginable 50 years ago. The last two secretaries of state were African American. I don't think anybody could have conceived of that 30 years ago. That's extraordinary change. Thousands of black office holders. The last I saw, 8,000 or 9,000 African American office holders in the United States, compared to numbers you could count literally on both hands and feet in the 1960s. Right, that's how much change. On the other hand, you have a world in which African-American males are more likely to be in prison than in college. You have an African-American underclass where people live in desperate poverty. Unemployment rates are enormous. The likelihood of escaping that poverty and achieving the American dream are negligible. You have young children in violence-ridden ghettos who are planning their own funerals rather than planning their future lives. Is it the case that anybody benefits from perpetuating that? Put that way, I think the answer is hard to answer in the affirmative, but it requires a significant expenditure of effort and resources to solve that problem. And the way I would phrase the question is, would there be a larger societal commitment to eradicating poverty and fixing these problems if it were a white underclass rather than an African-American underclass? And I think the answer to that is yes. I can't prove that. I think one reason why the United States intervenes in Bosnia but not Rwanda is the race of the people who are being victimized. I think that's plausible. I don't think it's conceivable we would have the same sorts of vindictive criminal policies, putting people in jail for the rest of their lives when they deal crack cocaine but not powder cocaine, and it turns out that the large majority of the crack cocaine dealers are African American. So I think, you know, the way that constitutional theorists talk about this today is a kind of selective indifference or unconscious bias. I think there's a lot more of that. I don't deny some open racism, but I think there's a lot more of that than there is the other. The question is, it just requires big expenditures of resources to solve the problem, and I think people are not that willing to do it, partly because the problem is a racial one. Yeah. Yeah. There are a couple of young experts on the Obama candidacy. Maybe you want to talk about it? My daughter and her friend Beth? No? No? Okay. You know, I don't really feel qualified to talk very much about this. I mean, it's clear. There are a couple things that are clear. There are a couple things that are possible. So, you know, the disparity in the New Hampshire results from the New Hampshire exit polls raises the possibility that we're still in a world where there is a significant percentage of voters, maybe 5 to 10%, who will tell exit pollsters what they think they're supposed to say, but in the privacy of the voting booth will still vote with race as an influence. That's a famous phenomenon. I think it's called the Tom Bradley effect after the California gubernatorial race in 1982. We clearly saw that in Virginia in 1989 when Doug Wilder narrowly, very narrowly, won the gubernatorial race when the exit polls showed he was going to win by a substantial margin. There is a possibility that the New Hampshire results show that. I don't think it's clear. There are other possible explanations, but I think that's a possibility. You still see candidates playing the race card in a way that would suggest, since these people know what they're doing, they're marketing experts, that they think it will resonate with voters. You saw that in the Tennessee Senate race in 2006, where I think the very same person who was running the Willie Horton ads in the 1988 presidential campaign was manufacturing advertisements that again played into this fear of interracial sex. I don't know whether they were effective or not. It was a close race, not clear whether it cost many votes. I have a hard time understanding what Bill Clinton thinks he's doing when he refers to the Jesse Jackson campaign in the perspective of Obama. I don't understand what he's doing if he's not playing the race card again in that context. On the other hand, the exit polls are extraordinary, right? I mean, the exit polls show, not so much in South Carolina, but in Super Tuesday, there are states where white people are just as likely to vote for Obama as they are for Clinton. Interestingly, Latinos, maybe not so much, although that varies dramatically from state to state. That in some ways shows the complexity of American race relations today, right? It's no longer, as it was for most of the history of the American South, it's not a black-white issue. In the country, you know, I saw the number of Latinos were 30% of the Democratic electorate in the California primary. That's extraordinary. 70% of them voted for Hillary Clinton, only 30% for Obama. That's also fairly extraordinary. California is no longer a majority white state. The nation won't be majority white in another 50 years, right? Dramatic changes that really complicate the racial dynamic. It's no longer just black and white. So, you know, those are some of the thoughts. I'm not a real expert on this. My guess is that most people who are still influenced by the race of the candidate are not real likely to be voting for the Democratic candidate anyhow. I don't think that's likely to be the case, so I would be surprised if this ends up costing Obama votes. I think the country's probably ready for an African-American president, but I think there are probably some people who don't think that. Yeah.
Earlier you mentioned some events such as World War II that really pushed along civil rights and really motivated people. And I was just wondering what sort of event do you see in the near future that might do the same thing? And do you think Hurricane Katrina did? And if
right.
It didn't,
yeah, so you answered in the last sentence what my answer was going to be. Hurricane Katrina would seem like that sort of event. Hurricane Katrina unveiled to the nation what the situation was for the African-American urban underclass. I did some research in the last year or so looking back at press coverage, and the lead story in Newsweek, Time Magazine, was about Katrina and race. Op-ed people were writing articles about how maybe this would mobilize the country to make an effort to deal with the situation. President Bush went down to New Orleans and said this is a problem of poverty, and the problem of poverty is rooted in race. And 2 years later, there's not a mention of Hurricane Katrina in the President's State of the Union address. As far as I can tell, most people have forgotten about it. That makes me pretty pessimistic. I mean, I would think if something as dramatic as Katrina would not focus people's attention and really make people motivated to do this, then I'm a little bit pessimistic. I think ultimately the solution has to be a more general war on poverty, that I don't think you're going to mobilize a nation in which minority racial groups are a minority. I don't think you're going to mobilize a nation behind what is broadly conceived as a racial issue. I do think it's conceivable for the richest nation in the country to mobilize to try to deal with poverty issues in general. But, you know, the only candidate in this election who talked seriously about poverty didn't end up doing that well, John Edwards. So I'm not all that optimistic about that either. At the end of the day, I'm afraid that I don't have a lot of optimism to share with you. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't work and strive and fight. That's how things change. I just don't want to be all starry-eyed about it. Kim.
Can you comment on the Reconstruction period? Because I think the narrative that says that progress has gotten better, at least from my perspective, moral norms of society had sort of evolved over time. And you're describing it more going up and down. And I wonder if the 1870s period you talked about sort of gives an artificial picture of progress, because, and I don't know much about that period, but what extent was sort of occupation of Union soldiers allowing blacks to register to vote and hold office, so that in fact it doesn't really represent a spike.
Right. So it's a really good point. I was giving examples of progress toward formal equality, and I think your question gets a little bit at substantive equality, and you're also making the point that it was coerced equality through the Union military. A couple of different points to note in response. First of all, we shouldn't understate the importance of being able to vote and protect yourself politically. Martin Luther King Jr. said in the 1950s, "Give us the right to vote, and we will do the rest by ourselves." That was a common view in the NAACP, that if you had the right to vote, you didn't need lots of other government intervention on your behalf because you had the capacity to influence what government was doing, or you didn't need lots of other legal measures to protect you because you could protect yourself with the suffrage. I think there's something to that. I also think that sometimes formal racial change is important in affecting attitudes. I often think that what ultimately changes things over time is change through generations, and it's very important, for example, to cleanse the public sphere of racism. Even if you're not changing people's hearts and minds, if you cleanse the public sphere, you influence the way young people grow up thinking about race. So even if you're not necessarily affecting the hearts and minds of a generation that grew up under white supremacy, by changing the formal legal norms, forcing people to employ blacks, forcing people to allow blacks to vote, forcing people to ride on buses with African Americans, I think you probably change things intergenerationally, if not immediately. The last point is simply there is some evidence that the mores got worse. It's not just the formal change, but the mores as well. There were lots of interracial relationships that were accepted. Things as mundane as black jockeys at New Orleans racetracks, black prostitutes servicing white clients in New Orleans. Those things were eliminated in the late 1880s and 1890s. Black baseball players in Major League Baseball, blacks participating in the women's suffrage movement in northern organizations, and then excluded. So I think there's actually a fair amount of evidence that it's not just the formal law that changes, it's the substantive attitudes as well. Okay. Yes, ma'am. Right. Yeah, that's a great point. That more than anything, I think, is at the root of this nation's racial problems. It's hard to have a segregated, an integrated school system. It may be impossible if you have segregated neighborhoods. It's hard to have kids growing up with interracial understanding if they don't play with kids of different races. Again, I'm going to give you a pessimistic answer. I think if that problem was going to be solved, it needed to be solved at the time that it was happening. It was happening, and not everybody is aware of this, it was happening not because of private choice and because people choose to live with groups that are like them. It happened to a significant measure because state and federal government supported it. The national agencies dealing with lending money to banks would not lend to people who try to integrate neighborhoods. Local housing authorities ensured that public housing was segregated. Local police forces would not protect blacks moving into white neighborhoods who were driven out by riots. I don't know how you have a truly integrated society without having integrated residential patterns, and there's no reason to be optimistic about that. Racial patterns, at least involving African Americans, are as segregated today as they've ever been. What's extraordinary is African Americans who move into middle class and upper middle class neighborhoods still live in segregated African-American middle-class enclaves. And what's especially extraordinary is you look at other racial groups. There are two principal measures that social scientists use to gauge assimilation. They look at intermarriage rates and they look at residential integration. And what you find is Latinos and Asian Americans who've been here for many generations, fewer than African Americans, on both of those standards, they are much more assimilated than African Americans. So the interracial rate for Japanese American women with whites is 50%. For African Americans, it's 6%. And with residential segregation, you find the most affluent African Americans in Los Angeles are more residentially segregated than the most impoverished Latino Americans. I think that tells you a lot right there. Somebody wants me to say something happy, right? The Yankees lost the playoffs, yeah.
To what extent do you think, if at all, the rise, if only in political rhetoric, surrounding illegal immigration might have had an effect on the racial development of
Yeah, I think it has a powerful effect on Latinos, and I think will affect political dynamics. I mean, it's a I don't want to be too partisan about this, but it is, I think, a neutral observation. I mean, I think the Republican Party is killing itself for the next decade with its position on illegal immigration, given that legal Latino immigrants and citizens feel very strongly about this issue and see this as being racist. These are the exact same voters who we've heard for the last couple of electoral cycles are the marginal voters. This is who Karl Rove and George Bush were trying to bring into the Republican Party. And in 2006, there was a dramatic fall off in the Latino vote for Republican candidates. So I think it'll have a political effect. Minority racial groups don't necessarily unify into consolidated civil rights movements, right? 70% of Latino voters in California wouldn't vote for Barack Obama. Sometimes minority racial groups see each other as the adversary because they're competing for low-wage jobs, right? I mean, why were the working-class Irish Catholics who were so discriminated against in New York, why were they burning down the black orphanage? Right? Why are black people their enemy? Because they see themselves as struggling against these other subordinated groups. So I'm not sure that the increasing complexity of the racial mix is actually likely to produce a multiracial civil rights movement, but maybe an extraordinary leader could actually bring that about. I think you're struggling uphill to do that, because I don't think minority racial groups see themselves as necessarily having a harmony of interest. And immigration may be a good issue, a good example of that, right? Latinos feel very strongly about it. I don't know that African Americans, for the most part, are more supportive of immigrants than anybody else. So that might be, you know, that might be an issue where you don't really see the commonality of interest. Okay. All right, well, thank you very much for coming.
Before everyone leaves, I just want to present to Professor Klarman a dedication by BALSA, and the dedication reads, "The University of Virginia Black Law Students Association is proud to establish and announce the Michael J. Klarman Paper Competition Award. This award, in honor of his scholarly work on constitutional law and civil rights, recognizes outstanding scholarship that focuses on the relationship between law and the African diaspora. The competition also seeks to bolster intellectual discourse in the Commonwealth of Virginia. The award will be presented by the Center for the Study of Race and Law as part of its annual student scholarly paper competition. The competition invites submissions from all current full-time law students at accredited law schools in the Commonwealth of Virginia." Thank you.